All right, Bill, I'm going to get started. A lot of people may be joining us, but if not, that's okay. So, all right. Well, hello and welcome to the December 2024 edition of the DMSC Masterclass. This monthly class is for current DMSC students, faculty, and anyone interested in the Doctor of Medical Science program at the Arizona School of Health Sciences, A.T. Still University. We have the opportunity each month to hear from inspiring masters in the PA profession and in healthcare who have made a significant impact. Before we begin, a few reminders for our attendees. Please keep your microphones muted and feel free to share any comments or questions in the chat section during the presentation. We will have a Q&A at the end where you can unmute yourself, and Dr. Beth Popray, our program manager, will be monitoring the chat for any questions or comments. So, well, anyway, it's a pleasure today to introduce our guest, Colonel retired William Bill Tozier. Bill started his Army career with the California Army National Guard, joining a Mobile Army Surgical Hospital, also known as a MASH unit, in San Francisco while going to college. During his activation for training as a medic and then a 91 Charlie clinical specialist, he learned about the first PA training programs. After working 2 years as a nurse in Sacramento, he was accepted into Duke University's PA program. Upon graduation in 1976, he worked for a family practice in Pocatello, Idaho, 60 miles from my hometown, I might add. And Bill became the first PA in the Idaho Army National Guard, 116th Armored Cavalry Squadron. However, Bill felt like he wanted to see a little bit more of the world, and in 1982, he applied and was accepted for active duty. At his first duty station at Fort Campbell, Kentucky, he transitioned from field artillery into aviation. The flight surgeon training led to an interest in occupational medicine, and after a tour in Germany with an armored unit, the Army selected him to attend the University of Oklahoma's Health Science Center's occupational medicine program for PAs. He followed this with several tours in occupational medicine and preventive medicine departments at Silas B. Hays Hospital, Fort Ord, Irwin Army Hospital, occupational medicine consultant for U.S. Forces Korea, Fort Riley, Kansas, where he served as the chief of preventive medicine services. Then Evans Army Hospital in Colorado Springs, Colorado. So he's been around the block. During this time as an occupational PA, he deployed in 1989 to the Gulf War, serving as a squadron PA with the 3rd Squadron, 3rd Armored Cav Regiment as they did their swing advance into Iraq. He was then picked up for a doctorate in education, where he completed that at the University of Denver in 1999. This positioned him for his first tour with the Inter-Service PA program at Fort Sam Houston, Texas. He worked as the curriculum coordinator and taught public health. And in 2002, he was promoted to colonel, the first active duty Army PA to receive that rank. This led to his selection as a senior PA, physician assistant consultant to the Army Surgeon General. And while in this position, he promoted the development of the Tactical Combat Medical Care Course, the first Army program that trained Army medical providers to treat combat casualties on the battlefield, a program developed entirely by combat experienced PAs. He then deployed once again to Iraq, this time as a PA consultant with the 3rd Medical Command in Baghdad and Operation Iraqi Freedom. One of his accomplishments during this tour was to establish Army treatment of concussions on the battlefield and their documentation with a standardized evaluation. He concluded his 39 years with the Army by serving as the program director for the Inter-Service PA program from 2007 to 2010. He then retired to Washington State, where he joined the University of Washington MedX PA program part-time and taught a course in public health until 2016 when he retired. And I could go on, but Bill, welcome to our master class and thank you for your service.
Thank you very much, Randy.
Well, let's just jump to it, Bill. You started early on in that MASH unit with the California Army National Guard while a young man in college. What inspired you during those early years to initially join the military and particularly the medical field? And how did that early experience, shape your future career path?
Well, when I went off to college, I originally had wanted to become a dentist. Wasn't quite making the grades to get into dental school, and was just sort of drifting along in the mid 70s when the draft intervened. I ended up joining the MASH hospital, and I had a very smart personnel officer who, when he asked me what sort of training I wanted, I said I wanted to be a short order cook so I could travel around in my pickup truck and make money. And he said, "Well, no." He said, "I tell you what, Tozier, I got something else for you." And so he sent me to what they call the 91 Charlie program, or an LPN training program. In retrospect, this particular program was actually a very miniaturized PA program. That's what got me started. And it's interesting though, when your question here made me realize the impact that military medicine had on my career. Essentially, my first exposure to medicine was working in the military. And what I take away from that is the military medical system has it number one, it emphasizes education and flexibility. And so that's really what I came to enjoy, a career of education and flexibility.
Wow, that's a heck of a way to start, you know. And let's get back. You were the first PA, if I have the information correct, first PA in the Idaho Army National Guard in the 116th Armored Cav Squadron, also the 14th PA in Idaho, and the second one in Pocatello. So, what unique challenges did you face pioneering that role in those early days, and how did you overcome them?
Yeah, dealing with the guard wasn't too much of an issue. Although it's where I actually learned about sort of the combat arms and how they operated. But that was pretty easy, and the guard back then was really just a bunch of people that sat around the armories and counted up their retirement points each weekend. So the big difference was being the second PA in Pocatello, and I was working for a family medicine group that was raising a lot of contention in the community. And because they were bringing in specialists, they had this radical idea that the emergency room should be staffed by a physician 24 hours a day, and that really upset all the old-time physicians. And so by association with this particular group, the hospital said they didn't want any PAs in the hospital with their docs. Most of the specialists in town wouldn't talk to us as a PA. It was a pretty negative environment. At that point, we didn't have any state academy. So a few years later, there were about four or five PAs in town, and we held a CME event. And at the end of that event, we all sat in the room and said, we should form an Idaho Academy of PAs. And so we said, yeah. And so we went around the room and said, okay, Ron, you're president. Bill, you're secretary. Sarah, you're the treasurer. And I forget, Mike or something, you're going to be, this. And so that's how we formed the academy. So, but one of the interesting things that I learned was I did attend some events in town. And I got to meet some of the old-time general practitioners. And the one thing that I took away from this experience was that a belief that knowledge and skill in the treatment of a patient is not as important as the continuity of care. I attended some events with some general practitioners, and I had to show them how to read an EKG. These were practitioners that had been around for many years, but they were providing really good care for their patients because they knew what they had, they knew what they'd tried, etc.
Wow, I didn't. I don't know if I've asked you this before. If you ever knew Dr. Young from Soda Springs, and if you did, say nice things.
Yeah, so we'll just leave it there.
Okay.
I knew of him. Yeah,
Okay.
yeah.
All right. Yeah, he was a classmate of mine in high school. Okay. Well, anyway, great stories from the early days. I do want to talk to you. We talked a little bit during the introduction. About your transition from field artillery. First of all, I should ask you how your hearing is, but we'll go, that's a different story. You went from field artillery to aviation at Fort Campbell. How did that shift influence your interest later into occupational medicine?
Well, it was, I guess when I got to Fort Campbell, my first assignment, I was so excited. There were so many possibilities were opening up, and I could actually talk to the doctors in the hospital. I went around and introduced myself to all the physicians in all the different departments in the hospital. Because I was so pleased that they would actually talk to me. And one time at one of the division surgeons meetings, the senior or the division surgeon said, "Well, we have some openings for some aeromedical PAs, and who wants to go?" Well, there was about 30 or more divisional PAs there at Fort Campbell, and every single one of them said, "Hell no, you can't make me do that. I'm going to have to go out to TMC4, which was the troop medical clinic at the airfield, and they're going to make me work all day and do physicals." And these old PAs, they didn't want to work. They came in about 6 in the morning and they left to go fishing about 11 o'clock. And so I said, "Hey, throw me in the briar patch." And so I went down there and just was exposed to all this occupational medicine focused on aeromedical medicine, and that's what I continued to enjoy throughout my entire career, was just this ongoing learning and new experiences.
Wow. Well, we have to talk about the Gulf War, at least the first time that you were there with the 3rd Squadron, 3rd Armored Cav Regiment, making that the big advance. And while you were there, I was up north in Saudi Arabia supporting an F-15 wing. But what are some of the most significant medical challenges that you encountered, during that advance into Iraq?
Well, luckily I had been sort of prepared. Prior to being deployed there, I had been deployed down to Honduras, and my particular aviation unit was the essentially went to Sotocano and set up the first medical installation. Well, there was a must hospital, I think, or a field hospital on the other side of the airfield, but they only had two physicians, and they were just getting established. But I went through the process of learning how to prepare my troops for deployment, learning how to pack and prepare for tracking medical care. Where you're sort of distant from resources and trying to anticipate what type of problems what I would expect. So that I think I was lucky in that, because then I was able to, for this larger ramp up, I was able to I was really readily prepared. There really wasn't The only thing that was really unique about deploying during Desert Storm was the preparation and the concern we had for chemical warfare. So that, for example, when I deployed later, to Iraq, That was never a concern, but we were very concerned about chemical warfare. So that was an interesting focus and trying to keep everybody trained up on that.
Yeah, and I remember at first part of the war, we had air transportable hospital, and we were up north, but every time Saddam Hussein would shoot Scuds, they would come toward us and then veer off toward Israel, and we would have to get into mop gear. And one night in the middle of the night, we had a siren go off, and I walked out of my tent and saw two nurses running by in their nightgowns with gas masks on. And I thought, isn't this crazy? I mean, it was just, I mean, people were going to run into each other. It was really crazy, but we could spend the rest of the day telling stories like that. But thank you for your service. Did you ever get to meet General Schwarzkopf?
I mean, not personally, but he came by our unit and he gave one of his Storm Norman briefs.
I'll bet. Well, that's great. Well, you also made history during those days as the first active duty PA to achieve the rank of colonel in 2002. And for folks, that was rare in those days because we were so late moving into the officer ranks. It was rare to see PAs moving into even major, but Lieutenant Colonel and now 06. How did this milestone impact both your career and obviously the broader PA profession within the military?
Oh, it, I mean, I'm sure many of the others and those that are listening can speak to this, but it really was, I was just really excited to make Colonel. But when you looked at it in the bigger picture, it really was, it just opened the doors. I mean, I think later on we have a question in your interview about the changes of PAs. And but this one was very significant because it allowed PAs now, as a full colonel, you got to, well, you either commanded a large unit, which was important, or you worked at an executive level within the Army's medical command. And that was really fantastic because the Army medical system, for those that don't know it, is really divided into two very separate parts that only rarely come together. And that is, there's the field medicine, which is the medical people, equipment, and units that actually deploy with the combat arms, the actual people that fire the bullets and the missiles, et cetera. And then there's the medical people that are assigned to the hospitals in the United States. And the people working in the hospitals in the United States are just like the same people working down the street to some degree at Providence or whatever hospital system there is. And they've got their own structure based on medical care and the providers. The field units are a totally different ball game. And so you are now supervised by combat officers, and you have a tactical mission, and you have to respond to that. And the one of the things that happened historically that's important for people to know is that there used to be physicians all the time, and they were down in the battalions. And they were, that's what's called, that's why the position is called a battalion surgeon. And, but after, essentially after Korea, well, I guess also in Vietnam, there were probably some battalion surgeons also, but essentially with Korea was the last time there was really the battalion surgeons, and of course, World War II. And so what happened was they developed the PA, and the PA just fit right into the slot. And at this particular time, physicians were graduating from medical school and they were coming into the Army, but they hadn't completed a residency. So they were assigned to a battalion, like they might be assigned to an infantry battalion or an artillery battalion. And they spent most of their time lobbying with across the army base. Oh, ask me about my geographic theory of military medicine. Anyway, they spent their time lobbying the hospital to get into internal medicine, orthopedics, ophthalmology, whatever it was. The army eventually did away with that and only accepted physicians after they'd completed their residencies. But this opened up a whole number of slots for that weren't filled. And this was the same time that the PAs started hitting the scene in the military, well, and in the civilian sector. And so we fit right in. And this is important because if you don't have a slot, if you don't have a position, you can't exist. And one of the problems that's ongoing for us now is that all the officer slots are, or the total number of officer slots is set by Congress. And then further, the total number of colonels and the lieutenant colonels are also established. And in the meantime, in the medical world, you have the medical corps, the physicians, the nurse corps, the MSC corps, which includes physical therapists, administrative officers, well, not physical therapists, but lab technicians, other types of officers. All these slots are essentially taken up. So it's like arriving at a parking lot late, okay? And so this has been a continual fight for us. I really can't speak to the Air Force and Navy so much, but it certainly was for the Army. And so this has been a long, so it's been very important. And so to have us finally get up and being work in the medical camp, in the Surgeon General's office, and bringing that expertise, physicians no longer really knew what the soldier was, or what the soldier was doing, or what the soldier experienced, or even what type of wounds the soldiers were experiencing. They were just living in their little shell. I'm sorry about the bias. And they were over there in the hospitals because it had been up until the Middle East wars, it had been 30 years. And by that time, all the physicians who had been any sort of combat experience were long gone. And so PAs brought this to the executive level within the medical command. I mean, I was given the opportunity to write the policy for what was going to be the battlefield dressing. Which one of these dressings were we going to choose and select for, to control bleeding, and which one we're going to select and how we're going to do it and what we're going to do the procedures for using it. So that really made a really big difference. At the same time, you now had PAs becoming fully commissioned officers, not warrant officers, not commissioned warrant officers, but fully commissioned officers, which means that they could start taking commands. Now, commands do tend to be a little more generic, and so the parking lot, shall we say, is a little more open there. And so anyway, it was just really great. And I think having them at that level and getting that visibility made a very, very big difference.
Yeah, absolutely. And I can certainly attest to that as well. Well, this sort of branches into another question that I had for you. And this goes to the Tactical Combat Medical Care course that you helped develop, which was groundbreaking as the first Army program training providers to treat combat casualties in the battlefield. So, what key elements do you and your fellow combat experienced PAs prioritize when developing this curriculum?
So this is interesting. This again shows this absolutely great divide within the MedCom between doctors in the hospital and the combat units. And so if you come into the military and you're going to become an infantry officer, the infantry, the army sends you to Infantry Officer Basic Course. If you're going to become an artillery officer, you go to Artillery Officer Basic Course and you learn how to fire the weapons, how to maneuver as an artillery unit, how you play within the battlefield, all this. So if you come into the military as a medical officer, i.e., a physician, guess what? There was no course to teach you how to become a military medical officer in the field. And I was at Fort Sam there, and a number of the very first PAs who went over to Iraq, who were looking for Osama bin Laden, came back and they said, "Oh, wow, things are really different over there. The battlefield wounds and ATLS is not cutting it. ATLS is not going to work." Luckily, there had been one of the Surgeon Generals had started to change the combat medic course to be more field wound oriented for the basic army medic. So I got together these PAs and we sat them down in a room and we said, okay, let's take a look at the wounds, the pattern of the wounds, the situations, what you're going to have with you, how you're going to treat them at a location, what can you expect to have at a battalion aid station level, and then the current methods of evacuation. And so they came up with this TCMC. And then one fellow in particular, Jim Rice, Major Rice, took it forward and he found an empty building on Fort Sam. And he started doing the usual thing of that Army PAs and other do, shall we say, just sort of procuring the equipment and the supplies that he needed. And he set up and he ran the course. And initially we ran it, we were giving it just for PAs, and then eventually physicians started to attend it. And it's now, I think there may even be some. And I know there are PAs from other services that attended. So I think I am proudest of that accomplishment during my tenure because there is now a course. And of course, it's continually updated and changed with what types of equipment, medicines we have on the field, the changing environment. But it teaches you that another sort of key takeaway is that medical care must reflect both the population and the environment. And this was something that had been ignored up until that time. In fact, I think, if I remember right, the only course that was available for any of the surgeons prior to this course that were deployed to the field or to combat, they were told, oh, you need to take the, there was an amputation course. I think it was probably developed in the Civil War. I'm not sure, and may have been refined, but at any rate, that was the only course available to them. And so, anyway, I think we made great strides, although we never got any acknowledgement about that from the medical, from the docs.
Wow. Well, also tell us about the while you were there, the established standardized evaluation procedures for battlefield concussions, which has obviously become a huge deal, not only in combat, but in sports these days. What prompted that initiative and what impact did that have on soldier care?
So that was, we had all this treatment for or really for physical wounds. And so, but we I was with the 3rd Medcom over in Iraq, and I because of my ties with in preventive medicine, I got word that they had just developed a new protocol for treating concussions. And I said, oh, wow. And so I called over and I had the neurosurgeon who had chaired the committee, I had him send me a recording all about it. And then I said, Wow, we need to get this disseminated throughout the theater, the combat area where all the troops were. And because they're dispersed, and even though we had certainly much better communication than we did during Desert Storm. So I said, how can I disperse this? So every unit, or we had a public relations officer. And so he was a really great guy. So I went to him and I said, listen, I need to make a video and I need your help. And so I got his cameraman and we went around to some of the aid stations there in Baghdad. And we actually filmed PAs performing the different parts of this exam. And we put it all together. His cameraman did a terrific job of editing it and put it all together. And then we mass produced a whole bunch of CDs. And so I'm proud to say that in less than 2 months after this protocol was set by the Army, we were distributing CDs that physically showed them how to perform this in the theater. And the other thing that was really neat about this was the I like to say that during the Gulf Wars, JCO went to war, meaning that we started following, although our military is technically exempt from JCO requirements in the battlefield, the hospitals and the people started applying those same principles. I mean, it just makes sense. And so, as much as they could. And one of those was the electronic health record, which, of course, we all know is the greatest setback for medicine in general. But we applied this. And so, they actually had little handheld units that were now able to take this medical record to the medic level. And so, the nice thing was that we could combine this, we could get an electronic record of this concussion evaluation that would track back all the way with the soldier. That tracking back was a little broken at first, but it was there and eventually it was going to happen. So that was sort of fun.
Wow. Well, we talked earlier about your impressive 39 years of military service, and you did talk a little bit about the role of PAs in the military and how it's evolved during that time. And even decades now after the Gulf War, and the Iraq War, PAs are really finding niches and places in military. So, any more thoughts about the role that PAs are currently playing in the military?
Oh wow. So I did say that I wanted to speak to this. I have never seen a big I got to experience, I mean, just an incredible change. I mean, it's almost like going from a horse rider to a Ferrari driver. The difference between PAs when I came on active duty in 1982 and PAs when I left, what was that, 20, 30 years later, is so dramatic you can't even compare them. One of the things that really bothered me when I first got on active duty was the Army would train PAs, and what the at that point in time it was almost a reward for being a medic and being an E7. And you've got like 19 years in service, and yeah, we'll send you to PA school. That's a reward. You can retire as a warrant officer. You get a little more pay, blah, blah, blah. So these guys, it was mostly guys, I think Polly was the first female, but it was, would come out and they would graduate from the PA program. They would do one utilization tour. They'd be sent to, like Germany, because almost all I think over half the PAs were in Germany at that time, and then, or Korea. And then they'd come back and do what I called a retirement tour. So in less than 8 years, all this incredible talent was gone. And I said, well, this is even bigger than a waste. This is terrible. And so one of the things that I pushed for, certainly as I got into the academy, the PA program, was that we need to start picking younger people, because we want to get our money's worth out of them. And of course, coming along again with the full commissioning, they now started taking leadership roles. The older PAs, they were end of the year of the retirement. They'd put up with a lot of hassle. A lot of them were Vietnam vets. They were not volunteering for anything. They were just waiting for the 20 and they were going to get out. These new PAs that we started selecting, they were excited. They had a whole career ahead of them. And they had a career not only in medicine, but they also had a career in leadership, being fully commissioned officers. The PEAs that I see now are phenomenal. You can just take a handful of them, and I'm sorry, civilian PEAs don't even compare. These guys are motivated, they're incredibly sharp, and I mean, it was just night and day difference. It was unbelievable. And we also started selecting for people that were not didn't have the medical background. And I think some of the civilian pre-A's programs had also started doing that. So in the 90s, we started taking people that weren't didn't have medical background. One of my favorite PAs was a French horn player, and she turned into the most incredible PA. Absolutely fantastic. The one group of PAs we were never, or one group of soldiers that we were never able to get through PA school, which really disappointed me, was linguists. The Army selects people, runs a pretty extensive testing program, and then they send them off to the language school in Monterey, California, and they train them up in languages. And we had a couple PAs or a couple applicants who were accepted. One spoke Arabic, and I think another spoke Russian, and we could never get them through the program. The problem was they were auditory learners, and they couldn't handle the classroom. They weren't dumb. It was just it was a true sort of demonstration of how different learning styles really do impact. That was always a disappointment for me. No PAs. I went back in August to a meeting of Army PAs, and I was just astounded. I saw at least 20 full colonels, and it was just amazing. It just made me feel really good. And of course, as some of you may know, we saw our first military PA become a general officer, a brigadier general. So we have now finally broken the glass ceiling, and you can't play if you're not at the table, and we're now at the table. So, again, we still have the full parking lot, but we're working on it.
Yeah, that wonderful, wonderful information. Well, as you know, and a lot of people watching today know that many years ago that each service had their own PA program. And then at one point in time, they combined those into the inter-service PA program. And Colonel Tozier was able to go there and be in the inter-service PA program and actually lead that program. And while you were there, what were your main goals? And maybe the most important question is, what are the most significant achievements in shaping the next generation of military PAs when you were there?
Well, it was really great. Having the essentially what was a quad service, Army, Navy, Air Force, and Coast Guard PAs come through. it added the military form of diversity. And the nice thing was that we could still, we could no longer do gender-based jokes, we could no longer do racial-based jokes or nationality-based jokes, but we could always do service-based jokes. And so that was fun. But I think what it really allowed us was a greater pool of instructors. And so we were able to really get an excellent pool of instructors. And it wasn't just PAs, we got lab officers. And so I felt it really bolstered the inter-service PA program in terms of the training. And then the other nice thing as a result of this is that nowadays you go to a theater of operations, particularly like Southwest Asia, and it isn't just Army. I could walk across the base at in Baghdad where I was, and I'd run into an Air Force unit, I'd run into a Navy unit. And the other thing was that as the war got on, the Army expanded beyond their established units. And so they were essentially creating new units, and they needed new PAs for these medical units. And they ran out of Army people. So they started drafting Air Force PAs. Did not make the Air Force PAs happy. But by having trained together at they were talking the same language. They knew the things. They were familiar, not necessarily from the classroom, but just from, the BSing around and the telling of stories. And so we had a very integrated force. I think the medical command now is much more integrated with having medical officers, physicians from all different services working at different hospitals. So we truly, while it's not a true purple service, as they would say, just one medical command, the officers are much more integrated, and they're familiar with the environments and the roles that people have to play and the requirements and expectations. So I feel that the achievements were getting better officers. We were pulling in better students. The couple of the things that I did in particular was I tried to start to establish a more administrative stability and continuity. And so I set up patterns within the function of the IPAP to hopefully, so that when a follow-on officer from the Air Force or the Navy took over the program, there were records and there were procedures that they could follow, so that everything would continue smoothly, and it wasn't just like a total startup from the beginning. And of course, this is very important, as those that have worked in PA programs know, because you get accredited by the ARC-PA, and that's one of the things ARC-PA looks for is your continuity and how you're delivering your educational experience the same at a high quality. The other sort of unique thing that we did was one of my students attempted suicide. He committed suicide, but he failed, is the way I put it, and put the wrong size bullet in, and he was sort of embarrassed about that later. But there'd been more than one suicide attempt or suicide during the PA program's time. And part of this was we were taking students, some of them only a matter of weeks out of the combat theater, and we were putting them into the classroom. And we were running a class 8 hours a day, 5 days a week. And this was not their normal environment. Very few military students have attended class full time at a college level. They've done it part time. They've done it, via the mail or the computer. But they were really being thrashed, and they really hadn't time to sort of mentally refresh and rest. And so the last thing that I did before I left was I extended the academic year by 3 months, essentially another quarter. And the reason for doing this was I cut the classroom day down to 6 hours, and I included a mandatory time in the morning for them to do physical fitness, which of course is a military tradition anyway. But I wanted them to have lesser hours of classroom. I wanted them to be able to get out and exercise on a regular basis. And so that was the one sort of significant academic change that I made to accommodate the students.
Wow, that's an incredible amount of information and importance for those military folks. It's incredible. I'm gonna sort of take us into the home stretch here. Your career path also included some educational achievements, including a doctorate in education. And how did your academic pursuits enhance your ability to contribute to military medicine? And then later on, when you got out of the service and worked at the University of Washington's Med-Ex program.
The military, like I said, offers a lot of chances for education, and I was offered the chance to get a doctorate in education. And so I said, sure, I'll do that. What the heck? And so I didn't realize what a pain that was going to be. It was nowhere near as fun as my master's degree. I love master's degrees. Doctorates, ugh. And I only say that in a doctorate class because I went to a traditional, very traditional. I mean, these guys came out of the Yale, the University of Chicago. We blessed it. It was sort of like this religious experience for them getting, running a doctorate program. And so I gained absolutely nothing from the curriculum of that 2.5 years. But I did learn how to do research. I learned about statistics, and that was the important thing. And so that's what I carried forward. I really wish I would have given my eye teeth to being in a program like you have, Randy, which has a whole, it has classes like this that are useful. I mean, learning the history of education is only so important. But talking with current educators, my doctorate program was so backwards, they did not want to even talk about online education, which was just coming into the fore, like, oh, no, we don't do that, and so, but what I really got out of it was the appreciation for research. Having been a civilian PA before coming into the military, I'd kept a lot of good ties with some of the early PAs and the educators and the researchers. And so I think I was able to sort of string those two together. And I know, for example, there are some PAs that are still working with civilian researchers, like Rod Hooker and others. And so and now that, of course, they've started the military started their own doctorate programs, including research. And so I think that's been important. I sort of downplaying my doctorate program. I don't mean to downplay the doctorate or the research at all, but it so that I think that's, and of course the master's work, it all influenced my relationships outside of the military, and my outlook towards what it was to become a professional educator.
Yeah, very good. I think I'm going to jump to see if anybody has any questions. We've got maybe 10 minutes left, but I want to make sure that anybody has a question or two. And I know I'm going to pick on you, Kendra. Kendra is the mother of, if I remember correctly, two military pilots, maybe more. But tell us a little bit about that, Kendra, and if any questions you have for Colonel Tozier.
Hello, thank you very much. It was such a delight to listen once again, and I'm in awe of everybody's experience and the contribution that they make to our profession. Yes, well, my oldest son is a Top Gun pilot, and he is currently a Top Gun instructor for another 2 years. So he's in Fallon, Nevada right now, and I'm married to an Air Force Academy graduate who's served in the Air Force for 23 years. Now he's a Southwest pilot. So we've got that aviation in common for sure. But once again, I just want to say thank you so very much for your contribution to our country. Such a long-standing career and the contribution to our profession. It's just I am in awe of everything you contributed, and I'm just really thankful for the time you gave to all of us tonight. Thank you very much.
Oh,
Thanks,
thank
Kendra.
you.
Yeah, see, Mike Champion, you had a question.
Yeah, I
Yeah, I
think
wrote it down,
left,
but
but
that's okay. Well,
he asked whether I'd gone to Fort Rucker, and yes, I went to Fort Rucker. So yeah.
okay, so you're well equipped with the Attack 55, huh? The AH-55. Did you get to
Well,
fly that when you were there?
oh, you mean yeah? That yes.
The TH-55.
Yeah, I soloed on the TH. Interestingly, I just met a rancher out in Eastern Oregon, and she has her own TH-55 that she's flown for about 20 or 30 years.
Wow. Well, I'm of the belief that if you could fly a TH-55 for any skill level, then you could fly anything the Army has.
Could be.
Excellent. Any questions from anybody else? Well, one last question for you, Bill. I'm sure you're still busy. What do you do for fun?
Well, I'm mostly doing woodworking. I got drafted into becoming the president of our homeowners association here. I do a lot of camping and traveling. We have a little trailer. I have a pickup truck with a camper shell on the back, and also spend some time taking care or sort of long distance care of my mom, who's now 101. So.
Oh, bless her soul. Wow. Excellent. Well, as you know, with our doctorate program, it's made up. We have I don't know, somewhere right around 150 PAs currently in our program at different stages, and they're from right out of school to I think a year or two ago we had a PA who was 70 years old who graduated from our program, and from different walks of life. So, but they're all wanting to get the doctoral program, and as a longtime clinician and educator, what advice would you give to our DMSC students? And our graduates about their future in the profession.
I guess I was looking at that, and I think you need to keep fighting the fight to be a PA. I've been out of the profession for long enough that I'm not totally familiar, but I still worry about what I call the nurse pretenders. Those people that are practicing medicine without a medical license. I also was strong friends with physical therapists, and I've seen this tendency to create the doctorate to become standalone providers trying to equal the trying to you walk into an office and they say, "Hello, I'm Dr. Smith." And now you have to ask, "Well, are you a doctor nurse? Are you a doctor physical therapist? Are you a doctor dietitian? What are you?" And I know that PAs are not, and I would never hope that PAs want to really set up independent practice, but I do think that we need to be freed from that, works under the supervision of. I haven't chatted with Polly or other people in the armies. I'm assuming that that is still in the army regulations. But I think we can be independent without having to be sort of totally equal. But I think we're doing a really good job. I still continue to hear when I say to people that I'm a PA, "Oh, I love my PA." So that hasn't gone south, and that's really good. But I'm sure that you have new battles. I think that PA organizations are stronger in some communities than others. I've been in a couple communities where there doesn't appear to be any PA organization going, and that's sort of sad. I think you can't sit back. I mean, you can sit back if you're a nurse, or you can sit back as a doctor, because your profession is so well established, but you can't still sit back as a PA. You got to participate politically.
Yeah, well said. And especially now, I mean, as you said, there's so many things going on. And like my first preceptor always said to me, he says, "Don't ever forget it's about the patient." And all this other stuff is surrounding that. But gosh, thank you so much, Bill, for being with us this evening. And thank you for your time today. Again, thank you for your service. And let me say to the rest of the folks here, and we'll be listening later, please join us on January 20th for our next master class with Kurt Manley, longtime clinical PA, Navy veteran, and educator. And I wish you all a great evening and a happy holiday season. And thank you for joining us today. And thanks again, Bill, and the best to all of you.
Well, thank you, Randy, and thanks to everyone who's listened, who sat through this. Okay,
Absolutely.
and everybody take care.
Thank you guys.
Okay,
Bye-bye.
bye-bye.